Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with the Reason Podcast. Today we're talking with Lawrence Kotlikoff. He's a Boston University economist, and he's running for president as a write-in candidate, and he's on almost every ballot in the country as a registered write-in candidate. He's running with Ed Lemer, a UCLA economist. Kotlikoff has written a lot about the massive amount of debt and obligations that contemporary Americans are pushing onto future generations. Books like The Clash of Generations and The Coming Generational Storm are his ways of talking about how awful this is and how ruinous it is, both for today's economy, but especially for future generations. His response to this is to come up with what he calls purple plans, things that will appeal, he thinks, both to liberals and conservatives. He's no libertarian, that's for sure, but he actually talks about a lot of things that libertarians are obsessed with, too, things like government spending, tax policy, healthcare. And there's a lot of interest in his there's a lot of reasons to be interested in his policy proposals that he talks about at Kotlikoff2016.com, his presidential campaign. So here we go. We're talking to Lawrence Kotlikoff.
You talk a lot about how the government is systematically masking the amount of the debt that is actually in play and all of the commitments that the government has made that they're not really counting on the books. We now have a kind of general national debt of about $20 trillion. By your calculations, it comes to about $200 trillion. What are we missing in the kind of public accounting of national debt?
Okay,
and
so
then like what matter? Okay, why does it matter? Yes.
Well, just like Bernie Madoff lied about his true liabilities and what his assets were, he lied about his balance sheet. Our government has, since six decades worth of our governments have been lying about our true financial situation because they've used words to keep liabilities, debts off the books. Like, as an example, my Social Security benefits that the government will have to start paying me when I reach, because I had a way to collect them till then, they're off the books. Your Social Security benefits that are going to come to you off the books, your Medicare benefits, your Medicaid benefits if you need them. Spending for defense into the future, we're going to have a minimal, you know, some level of defense. It's off the books. So all the expenditures out into the future, apart from the servicing the official debt, are off the books. And then you take the taxes, which are the assets to cover those expenditures, they're in the future. They're also off the books. So the only way to do the bookkeeping properly is to do present value fiscal gap accounting. Look at all, put everything on the books and see what the value in the present of all these future spending commitments is compared to the value in the present of all the future taxes.
And how far
and that's $206 trillion. And,
okay.
Well, the fact that it goes out, you can't truncate this calculation for reasons that unless you this is somewhat, you know, technical reasons, but what words we used to describe our receipts and payments from Uncle, the receipts Uncle Sam takes in and the payments he makes are arbitrary. That's why he's so that's why the government's so easily able to keep things off the books. They can just, rather than saying that they're borrowing money from you and going to give you principal plus interest in the future or something, you know, principal plus interest plus something else, a transfer payment. What they do is they say, we're taxing you now and we're going to make a big transfer payment in the future.
Right.
Now, just that choice of words for the same money that they take from you now and give you back in the future, how they call that will determine whether or not it gets called borrowing or, and if it gets put on the books and that obligation in the future shows up on the books or not. And that's how they've kept, you know, our true official debt in the hands of the public after the Fed has printed something like $5 trillion to pay for to buy out the debt that was issued. And a lot of that occurred in the last 9 years. That's about $13.5 trillion. The fiscal gap right now, as estimated by Auerbach at Berkeley and Bill Gale at Brookings, is around $206 trillion.
Okay,
so we're off by about a factor of 15. So our true indebtedness is 15 times larger than is being reported. Now, Clinton and Trump have not mentioned fiscal gap
Well, they haven't. Yeah, they haven't really mentioned anything about, you know, deficits, national debt, even the just spending versus taxes. Yeah. Other than that, they're going to cut. Let me ask you this: you know, if overall national debt is around $20 trillion, and if debt owned by the public, which is a subset of that, is, you know, maybe 13, 15, 16, you're saying the real debt is $200 trillion, or $206 trillion, the real fiscal gap. What is the effect of having this much debt, which, however you're measuring it, it has gone up massively in the 21st century? It started with George Bush and a Republican Congress. It finished with Democrats, a Democratic Congress, and a Democratic president. Why is
I'll tell you what it means.
What are the effects of it? Why should we worry about it?
Because we're leaving this bill in the laps of our kids. They're going to be forced to pay potentially 65% higher taxes when we start raising taxes, or they're going to have to face, or they'll have to face massive cuts in spending and expenditures for them.
So if I can just stop for a second. Yeah. Basically what you're saying is that we're living off of, if you want to call it credit cards or whatever else, but we're maxing out what the government is giving us, and somebody is going to pay that bill, and that bill is going to come due either.
We are stealing from our kids. Yeah.
And they're either going to get much higher taxes or lower benefits, or probably some combination of both.
Yeah, and the longer we wait, the bigger the burden is going to be. And let me just explain, this is a pattern, not just with respect to fiscal policy, and I'm not running for president at KotlikoffF2016.com just on the basis of issues of fiscal generational policy,
right?
But also how to fix our fiscal institutions, how to fix Social Security, how to fix healthcare, how to fix taxes, how to fix banking, how to fix immigration, how to fix education. So there's a lot of new ideas that economists, I think, generally agree on how to approach these problems, immigration as well. So, and then I've also discussed foreign policy. Now, this policy that we've been running, which is to screw the next generation at our benefit, at the benefit of older people, screw our kids, our grandkids, our great-grandkids, and it's called I view it as take as you go. It's a Ponzi scheme, basically, that's been run, because we've been keeping things off the books. But it runs throughout. It's pervasive policy. If you look at how we're treating North Korea, we're leaving our kids at risk of their having nuclear weapons that can hit anywhere in the U.S. because we already let them develop nuclear weapons. Then we let them miniaturize them into nuclear warheads. Now we're letting ballistic missiles. Now, then you look at climate, leaving them at the risk of a complete apocalyptic disaster there.
So you're saying the intergenerational...
And then, let me just say a couple more things. There's a long list here,
I hear you.
I was just listening to the discussion of how we're dealing with nuclear waste. We've built all these nuclear plants. We have no place to store the waste. So we've got nuclear facilities around the country that a terrorist could blow up and a disaster because of that. If you look at education, how we're shortchanging kids on education, if you look at immigration, how we're reducing the wages of young people and low-skilled people in general because we're bringing in a million people a year legally, not illegally, to compete for their jobs, to the benefit of older people who get to hire these folks at a low price. All this stuff is of a pattern of a nature. So if you care about your kids, I would hope you'll look at KotlikoffF2016.com and write just four words on your ballot in the spaces provided, which are Lawrence Kotlikoff, where it said ask for the writing candidate for president, and Lawrence and Edward Lehmer for the vice president, because we can actually, within the next 2 weeks before the election, get the word out, but also write us in and change the future of our country.
Okay, let's talk about a couple of things, okay? And we'll get to specific policy proposals as well and kind of spar a little bit on that. But, you know, you're like a leading-edge baby boomer, right? You're right around 65. Where did this generational kind of "fuck you" attitude come from? And you know, because it's, you know, you say, and I agree with you, we're leaving in many ways a much more volatile world for our children, particularly in terms of government service goods and services. When does that bill come due? And when do, I mean, you know, because the fact is,
you know,
is that
it's come to a ready. It's not that we're broke in 50 years or, mm-hmm. or 30 years or 20 years. We're broke today. The credit card bill, it's a present value. So it means that we're short $206 trillion today. If we don't start paying that off, it's going to be bigger next year. It'll be bigger by $6 trillion bucks next year. So that's the true deficit that we're running, about $6 trillion bucks. Not the $400 billion that President Obama is talking about, or Clinton is talking about. So the truth is that Clinton and Trump know nothing about our fiscal condition. They know nothing about how to fix the state of these dysfunctional state of the tax system, and the Social Security system, the healthcare system, in terms of how to actually fix it. Bill Clinton had the guts to talk about how crazy the design of Obamacare mm-hmm. is in terms of its impact on work incentives. But you're layering that. I think it's a great thing that he got that passed relative to people not having insurance. Mm-hmm. But we need to get rid of Obamacare, get rid of Medicare, get rid of Medicaid, get rid of employer-based health care, that subsidy.
Let's talk about that plan.
Instead of something from scratch. Okay.
Yeah. So let's talk about that plan, because you said you worked it out with John Goodman, who's a well-known name in the kind of free market community. People have assailed it. Critics have assailed it as saying you're talking about a voucher for health care. But what you're actually talking about is a voucher, essentially, or a payment coupon from the government that would allow people to buy basic health care, and then they can build up from that. Talk a little bit about why that would be a more efficient system for delivering health care and not cheating people out of tax dollars that they'll never see again.
Well, John's brilliant insight, and I think he's a brilliant economist, is that everybody needs to have a basic health insurance plan. I think that's a generally viewed perspective at this point. And we want to have a highly competitive market. We want to have private provision by health insurance companies who are competing with each other, just like they were competing for selling and buying wheat. Mm-hmm. We're trying to make healthcare into wheat, in effect. And here's how you do it. You provide a voucher to each person based on their pre-existing conditions, health conditions. And that means that if you have diabetes, you get maybe a $30,000 voucher. Mm-hmm. If I don't, maybe I get a $5,000 voucher. Mm-hmm. What it does is it tells the insurance company that they can make money make money on the guy with a $5,000 voucher.
Right.
So now everybody's going to have a voucher, the same coverages, the same policy. It's not a gold, basic plan that everybody has. And it's all being paid for by the government. You take your voucher to your insurance company. You get your voucher once a year based on your condition. You take it to the insurance company. You sign up with that company. They take the voucher to the government. They get paid the amount on the voucher. Now they're responsible to take care of you. Now they've got the incentive to make sure their doctors don't over or under provide health coverage. Their doctors and networks of hospitals, et cetera.
And that's because you can go somewhere else. If they're screwing you over, you'll go somewhere else.
If they screw you over, every year you can move. Mm-hmm. And they want to keep you coming because they're making money off of you. Everybody would be forced to provide the basic plan. If you wanted to buy insurance, supplemental insurance for angioplasty at 98, you could do that. So we're not requiring everybody to have exactly the same.
So in that way, you get out of the problem with the Canadian system, where there is no system outside the government system, but you also avoid the problem with the national health in England, where the basic plan is provided by the government, so everybody who can evacuates at 100%.
Yes, this is this is a multi-provider single-payer system. So the term single-payer is a misnomer. We already have a single-payer in our country.
It's Medicare.
Not entirely. Well, it's Medicare, Medicaid, Obamacare, and they subsidy to employer-based health care.
Right.
If you add these four things up together, you find that the government is paying for 60% of our health care right now,
right
today, maybe 65%. So to think that we don't have a single payer, or mostly a single payer, already is ridiculous. You don't know the numbers.
Why is it bad to have health care linked to the employer, to a person's job? Because that's how
we're killing employers by giving them jobs that they have nothing to do with. Fundamentally, their job is to hire us and make money and to be profitable. But if an employer has to figure out an employee's health care and an employee's saving behavior through the 401k, and then their investment behavior, and then their life insurance, all these things are due to the tax system providing incentives for employers to do that. There's all this stuff originated in the early 50s, where what happened was, it's really partly a Ponzi scheme too. They started defined benefit plans, where older executives and older union leaders set up these plans to differentially benefit them and leave the basically get freebies at the cost of future employees or the shareholders, and then the shareholders turned around and screwed the future employees by freezing their plans.
Mm-hmm.
That's just an example of how this whole thing got started. It got started by a scam, okay? And the employees should never have been involved in the reason that employee plans on the healthcare side got started, I think, has to do with this cherry picking. With a large employer, people aren't joining that employer because they've got diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
They're joining the employer just to work. And so you have this whole pool of large pool of people with a lot of different pre-existing conditions. So the insurance company doesn't have to worry about some bad risk coming at them when they insure the entire population of Boston University, for example, mm-hmm. 10,000 employees. But, so you need to have pools, and that's what I'm proposing, which is one big pool, but the insurance companies having no incentive to cherry pick because they're going to get compensated for the extra risk. So basically, we have this is what we call adverse selection in economics.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm proposing is to go directly at that information problem by making the information available, by disclosing it. If I give you a voucher for $30,000, I'm disclosing that you're six times sicker and more expensive than somebody who's got a $5,000 voucher. So let the information get out there. Let the government cover the cost. Let's use an efficient tax system to pay for this. And I've got a brand new tax system, brand new Social Security system, brand new food stamp system, brand new
So point out to listeners too that I mean that interest in getting clear information out into the public is a real theme of your work. It's a real motif. That's what the Social Security book is about. That's what your generational accounting attempts are doing. So, I find that particularly interesting because we live in a so-called information age, but in fact, it seems as if the real data often gets buried under a lot of kind of useless, unending stream of information. Talk a bit about your tax policy. And, because this is something also, and keeping in mind that reason speaks to and for libertarians mostly, there's some really interesting aspects of your tax reform policy. Talk about the main components of that and how you think that will affect economic behavior.
Okay, thanks for asking that. The tax system right now is dysfunctional. We have a federal income tax, which allows the super rich to pay nothing. And when I talk to billionaires, I meet a bunch of them all the time. Not all the time, but occasionally I meet billionaires. I probably met 5 to 10 in my day. And when I talk to them about the taxes they pay, they start to laugh because what they do is they have a whole bunch of assets. They're diversified. They don't pay, throw off any dividends. They just grow and produce capital gains, but they don't realize these capital gains, so they never report any income. So no matter what Hillary puts those tax rates at the top, these people won't pay taxes because they don't report income. What they do is they just borrow against those assets, and they pledge the assets as collateral, and they take their losses.
So the point is that you're not, an income tax is a really inefficient way to capture
the income tax system is a total mess. The estate and gift tax is a voluntary tax. It's a total mess. It's got it's a Full Employment Act for lawyers and accountants and bureau government tax authorities, but it.
And shouldn't the main function of the taxes at the federal level be to generate the revenue necessary to provide the services we want to provide?
Yeah, right.
So that all gets lost, right? Because we're in a perpetual deficit. So now it's just, how do we maximize tax revenue?
We have too low, and we've got three dysfunctional taxes: the estate and gift tax, the personal income tax, and the corporate tax. The corporate tax has the highest effective marginal tax on companies investing in our country. That's why our investment rate's only 4%, used to be 15%. And that's where we're driving companies out of this country. On the other hand, there's so many loopholes that the tax brings in very little revenue, historically low levels. So that's the third, just a functional tax. And then if you take a look at the entire fiscal system, which is the tax system, the social security system, the healthcare system, and the welfare system, you find that the marginal tax rates, when you put everything together for poor people and middle income people and rich people, are extremely high, especially for poor people. If you're poor, if you're around, you know, you work for McDonald's with your wife maybe, and you've got food stamps, so you've got a couple kids, you're on the earned income tax credit, you're getting welfare benefits. Well, here's what happens. You earn an extra 23 cents in food stamps, 22 cents in the earned income tax credit. Mm-hmm. You lose 15 cents in the FICA tax. You lose 5 cents in the Ohio state income tax if you live in Ohio. Mm-hmm. You lose 5 cents in their sales tax. So you're already up to a very high thing. And then you could lose your Medicaid, or you could lose your Obamacare subsidy. So you can easily be in an 80% tax bracket, and you're not even paying any federal income tax. So we've got about half of the poor. If you go to Kotlikoff.net, quality in the country, and also the work disincentives.
Right.
For older people, it's even worse because it's worse in different ways. They face the Social Security earnings test, which they perceive to be a 50 cents on the dollar tax. So we're locking people out of work. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you ask, how are you going to get the middle class to revive the middle class and get the poor out of poverty? Well, you don't do it by locking them into poverty by saying, earn an extra $10,000 and get nothing, or get next to nothing. You don't do it. So that's why I'm reforming everything at once.
Okay, so run through the major reforms that you're talking about.
Okay, so the tax, let me just tell you on taxes. I get rid of the income tax, personal income tax. I get rid of the estate and gift tax. I get rid of the corporate income tax. And now we're going to have the lowest tax, the most tax-friendly investment environment in the world, because there's no corporate income tax. We're not going to have the highest corporate income tax. We're going to have the lowest of any developed country. Then I'm instituting two consumption taxes. One's a value-added tax. That's the thing that Ted Cruz was proposing, and that every developed country in the world has, 20% value-added tax, plus a progressive consumption tax, a personal consumption tax that's progressive, that begins after $100,000 of consumption. So it's just on the rich. And
how does that work? Just very quickly, how does the government know? How do you know that you've spent $100,000 and that the 101st?
It's a cash. It operates as a cash flow tax, money in, money out. And anything you invest, it would be money out. Anything you gave to charities would be money out. Mm-hmm. So that wouldn't be taxed. Wage income would be deductible. So we're not going to tax wages through this. It's really an indirect way of.
So who does that, though? Does your employer keep that accrual going? How do you keep?
No, Donald Trump has money coming into his accounts. Mm-hmm. It's a checking account and money going out. If he can't show that he's increased his saving over the course of the year. This is a proposal worked out by Senators Nunn and Domenici in the 80s. It's called the USA tax.
Right.
So we now have the data from the internet to do this. It's based on worldwide consumption and also the consumption services that Donald Trump would get from his yachts and his airplanes and his cars, whatever, and his mansions.
Yeah.
All those consumption services would be included in the base. So trust me, Donald Trump would pay taxes, and every other super rich person would as well. And under Hillary, nothing would change for the super rich.
Right.
And I'm putting everybody, because of my set of reforms, nobody is paying, everybody's paying 30 cents on the dollar in terms of labor taxes.
Right.
So a proportional labor income tax.
Well, talk about why is a consumption tax, and this is something I think that certainly a lot of free market people that I know, and many economists say, if you want to get rid of the distorting effects of taxation so that the government isn't picking winners and losers or certain types of behavior through the tax code, a pure consumption tax is best. It distorts less.
Well,
but what in general, not your specific plan, but why are consumption taxes more effective and less distorting than other forms of taxes?
Consumption taxes don't influence when you consume. They're not telling you, they're not giving an incentive to consume more in the present and save less in the present and consume less in the future. Mm-hmm. And so they're neutral. There's no asset income tax component of consumption taxation when you look at the math. So let me just also mention the other elements of this tax plan. There's a negative income tax of $2,000 per person because we're not going to have the earned income tax credit. Take food stamps, and I put them into a separate food distribution system. So tax associated with earning more money.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a carbon tax of $80 per metric ton of CO2 emissions. I've got an inheritance tax that kicks in after $5 million. Of inherited wealth.
Mm-hmm.
It's a 20% inheritance tax. So there's no estate and gift tax, but there is an inheritance tax.
You know, you're so, killing my my incentive to make a lot of money to leave to my kids, though.
If you spread it out, if you can leave each of your kids $5 million, they won't pay any taxes. If you leave them $5 million and $1, they'll pay 20 cents. I think they can afford it.
Okay.
Okay.
Fair enough.
If that's your problem. And, So this is of our entire economic policy structure here, because it's all sick and dying. And you asked the question, how do we know when are we going to go broke?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was in the Amtrak station in the Back Bay, and I noticed that they had no Amtrak. They had closed down the office for the Amtrak personnel because they couldn't afford to hire them anymore. That's an indication. If you look at the funding of the National Science Foundation, that's an indication, or the National Institutes of Health, or like R&D the government's involved in. You see signs everywhere. If you see the creeping, crawling additional taxes being thrown into Medicare Part B premiums for high-income people, but there's no indexation of the ceiling. If you look at all the aspects of all the places where we're being nickeled and dimed and all the money that the government's printing, you see signs that the government is broke. And it's not broke in the future. It's broke today. We cannot do things that cuts back in defense. That's all for a reason. The country is broke, dead broke. And we need to address this. And we've done this on the backs of our kids. We have screwed our children big time. And it's time for people that are younger, millennials, to pick up the torch here and spread the word to everybody else in their generation that there's actually a candidate who's sticking up for their interests, and it's got a choice of somebody who knows nothing and somebody else who's going to do nothing. That's Trump and Clinton, or somebody who's going to fix the problems. Nuclear North Korea. I'm calling for an enforcement of an immediate ban on their testing of missiles of any kind, and also their testing nuclear weapons.
Who do you send when North Korea says, hey, you know, President Kotlikoff, fuck you, and keeps doing stuff? Then do you send those young people who voted to put you in office?
With our Air Force, their entire, and our Navy, their submarines, all their launch pads, all their missile facilities, all their nuclear weapons production facilities. We destroy those in an afternoon. If they were to attack Seoul, we would destroy their country in a day.
So you are a hawkish person.
I'm an adult. Okay. You know, if you look at John Kennedy, he was given JFK when the Cuban Missile Crisis occurred. This is the modern day version of the Cuban Missile Crisis. I'm not a hawk when it comes to confronting Russia. For example, let's figure out what the Russians and we can do together to move ahead. We don't have an inherent.
Shouldn't we let Korea, Japan, and China, and possibly even Russia, deal with North Korea? It's a very distant, minor threat.
They're not doing it. We've tried that for 35 years to make that telephone call that Trump thinks they're going to make just because he's elected after he's been insulting them for months now. The guy's delusional. He's got a mental illness of some sort. He needs to go back to kindergarten to learn some behavior. But
cannot go wrong by talking down Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, for sure. Larry Kotlikoff, let me ask you this. Your presidency, your presidential run, is predicated upon really converting and flipping millennials and getting them to attack the baby boom generation, of which you are a part, of which I am a part. And, you know, the baby boom generation flipped off its parents and the greatest generation. How are you doing among young people, and what grabs their attention? Because they're the ones we're sticking with the bill for all of this, whether it's environmental, whether it's fiscal, whether it is economic activity. How are you doing among millennials, and what registers with them?
So I don't know how many.
And can you? I'm sorry. Can you repeat that again? Because you dropped out for a second.
Sure.
So how are you doing with millennials?
I don't know. The polls that Nate Silverman and others have been running haven't included my name, and that's not. So I don't know how far my message has spread, but I got an email from a guy from the Sudan this morning, encouraging me to run. I got the top Russian newspaper writing articles about my candidacy. The top two German newspapers have written about my candidacy. The top Australian and Danish newspapers. So this word is spreading. So I don't know how far it's spread. We've got
We've got
20,000 economists trying to send chain email letters this week to the public, and to other economists and to colleagues. In all kinds of fields. So we hope the thing will go viral. It may not, and we may be back where we may have 4 more years or 8 more years of a do-nothing government, get nothing done, of civil war within the government. And that will be a terrible shame for our kids, because what we're doing is we're taking our kids to the cleaners. We're transforming our fantastic country into Argentina. Slowly but surely. This is like a slowly growing cancer that we're ignoring, we're putting band-aids over, and it will get at an organ at some point, and we'll end up back as a developing country like Argentina is. 100 years ago, Argentina was one of the, 110 years ago, Argentina had the fifth highest per capita GDP in the world. It's now, it's an emerging country again.
Right. It can happen here, and it will. You're saying can happen here, and it will.
Yeah, it's a record, a story of bad government, bad government, and that's exactly. So Trump is channeling a proper actor. He's just not fit to well, I want to get
so I mean, but and your standard line, which makes a lot of sense. Trump doesn't know anything, and Hillary won't do anything to prevent the slide into an Argentine future.
Know nothing and know nothing and do nothing candidates. That's what we've got to do.
And, give,
and,
we were,
and these people and our quote democracy has force fed us these two people. Only 14% of the population or the adults voted for. Pushed Trump on us, and a different 14% pushed Clinton on us. It's not like this is democracy. This is something you'd see in Russia today, not in the United States.
Well, we are going
voting
to
for me.
Yes, we're going to leave
democracy.
It there, Larry. Give your website one more time.
So it's Kotlikoff, my last name Kotlikoff2016.com. Hope everybody goes there. Spread the URL today. Ask. Set up chain letters, send a letter to 100 people that you know, an email, tell them just to spread that email to another 100 people, have them continue the train.
It'll be the world's largest virus. So, no, thank you very much.
Yes.
And good luck. Hopefully it'll be a financial, a responsibility virus. We could use that. We've been infected by enough malware in the system. I want to thank Lawrence Kotlikoff. He is a Boston University professor, author of The Clash of Generations and The Coming Generational Storm. He is running for president with Ed Lehmer of UCLA as a writing candidate for president. Go to Kotlikoff2016.com, and you can get the full rundown on him. Thank you so much, Larry Kotlikoff, for talking to us.
My great pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.